Thanks so much for being with us tonight on Coast to Coast AM. My guest is Dr. John Alexander, author of the new book, UFOs, Myths, Conspiracies, and Realities. And it stirred up quite a fuss, even though it's only been out for a couple of days. This is his first major interview. We're covering a lot of ground, including his belief that UFOs, while they're very real and very interesting, that there is no central controlling group in charge of the cover-up. And that would include MJ-12. When we come back, we'll jump into the story of MJ-12, the problems that Dr. Alexander has with it, as well as the Roswell story. So stay with us on Coast to Coast. Dr. John Alexander, what do you make of the whole MJ-12 story? I mean, that's the group in general that for the last 15, 20 years or so is presumed to have been in charge of the UFO cover-up based on these leaked documents. Give me your take.
Well, nothing, but can I first back up to something you said as we were going to break that I think is really important and totally sure. missed by the field.
Sure.
And that is, you said, later we would talk about strategic issues and things of that nature. There is a small group of people who think that UFOs are, you know, the greatest story never told. The reality is, and the reason this does not play in the government, is there are so many other things going on in the real world that are biting them in the butt today. As we know, you mentioned in, you know, the introduction, the things that's happening across North Africa and the Middle East today. These things actually play directly into UFO arena, and it is the reason that they are a very, very low priority when it gets to, you know, from the government interest. They just don't wash well enough. It is, like I said, you got a small group who are intently interested. You've got a modest-sized group who say this is all nonsense and, you know, just misidentification and, you know, the skeptics and debunkers you talked about. And you have this vast group in the middle who say, you know, interesting, but, you know, not a burning issue for them. So when I compare this to, you know, global terrorism, to the financial crisis, the healthcare crisis, you go like, where does this fit? And the answer is very, very low. Now,
you go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I was going to jump back to your question, but.
Well, no, that's okay. Let's wait a second while we're on this topic, because you mentioned earlier in passing the Northern Tier incidents where UFOs appeared over a series of our nuclear missile bases over the course of a couple of weeks. You also mentioned the example that we dug up in Russia about a very alarming incident where Russian ICBMs were basically ready to go, ready to launch in association with a UFO incident. Those would seem to be legitimate national security incidents that would be of interest to our military, unless there's some other explanation we just don't know about. But are you saying that they are so infrequent, even though they are dramatic at times, they're so infrequent that there's always going to be something more pressing at the moment?
Well, there's always something more pressing. I mean, if they actually caused that launch or something of that nature, that might have got their attention. The response in the missiles here was, it happened once. There was an investigation done. Didn't figure out what it is, and they said, well, if it happens again, then we'll kind of get serious. There was no threat in general in the Northern Tier sightings, lots of UFOs around sites and things of that nature. This is why when the hearings that you were talking about, we kind of geared it towards, we ought to bundle these things together, and they do make a significant case and are worthy of studies. One of the things we've talked about in the government, but what we didn't talk about is the budget issues. And those are really, really critical. That's why in Leslie Keene's book, which is really pretty good, by the way, but I was a bit surprised when Podesta, who did the thing, supported a call for creation of a new agency. And you go, how do you do that in a time where the government's got to cut across the board? So as I put, the probability of a new agency being created, look at UFOs, snowballs have a better chance in hell. That's just not going to happen. But you got to remember the golden rule in all of this. And, you know, maybe that's another discussion we can get into. But it's, you know, you've got to look at the funding issues. And this is why I say my chapter on how the government really works is really critical. Our civics, even high school level civics, is not very good these days on how these things get done. You know, everything's a one. We mentioned requirements. You've got to have a requirement to do something. You have one to N priority list in funding, and you run out of money long before you run out of things that you ought to be doing in any department. And so then you got to prioritize UFOs against them. That's it. Tiny segment of the population think that's really important. The vast majority, you know, just not going to make the cut, literally.
Back to MJ-12, your take.
Well, UFOs, absolutely not real. And I know Stan Friedman's going to be jumping up and down, wrote the book on the topic and all of that. Most of the documents are undoubtedly bogus. It's interesting, when you go to the National Archives, there are two topics that are covered there that put out and just said, here's the information on. One of them is the Kennedy assassination, and the other is MJ-12. And I've covered in the book, and you know, literally verbatim, you know, here's what their take is. I actually filed my own FOIA on this, and I said specifically, I'm interested in MJ-12, not UFOs. And sure enough, I got back the letter that said, you know, the UFOs, blah, 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 and obviously a form response because they get so many. I did have somebody, and I addressed this in the book, tell me that, A, it was real, and B, that the list of people was accurate. And when I asked that individual, who should be knowledgeable, okay, can you tell me what it was? He says, I can't tell you. He says, but if you look at the list, you ought to be able to figure it out. And I have put in the hypothesis there, and you don't need UFOs, and you don't need, like what Stan Friedman had to do was explain how Menzel had a double life, because right. Menzel, who was on that list, was an adamant anti-UFO guy. And so they came up with, well, you really believe one thing that if you believe my hypothesis, you don't need that. It was, let's say, probably more critical than UFOs and very prosaic. And the point was that the timing, the people, everything just fits a different scenario.
What do you make of the idea that in those documents there were a lot of interesting things that were not publicly known at the time they came out? That's sort of lend credence to Stan Friedman's view on this thing. The Menzel's double life wasn't known at the time it came out.
And it's not true.
It's not true.
That's not true. Yeah, I mean he had to come up with that as a rationale to explain why Menzel would be reporting. The documents, many of them have actually been found, and they were other documents that had been just altered slightly to, take on the UFO twist. And like I said, I recommend. But one of the good things about my book is you don't have to believe anything I say, because we have named enough places and went, go do the research, and you got to take some common sense. And for some of the people that you mentioned, probably need to, you know, take a few breaths and, get their temper under control. But, you can follow these things straight through, and prosaic answers tend to prevail.
Roswell. Something crashed at Roswell?
Oh, undoubtedly something crashed. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think the Air Force handled it abysmally. And I do think that what you, it was not a weather balloon. I've had some questions on that. And, you know, certainly not a weather balloon. We agree it wasn't a weather balloon. Unfortunately, I think Mogul probably was the answer. And all of the things, I do think there's highly credible witnesses. I think Jesse Marcel and Jesse Jr. are really straightforward. And I think you can explain everything that they discussed, and again, without a UFO.
I don't even want to jump into that whole Roswell debate, but it's the one thing that stood out for me was the nature of the wreckage and how much material there was
Yeah,
stretched
well,
out
I
over.
there's a couple things that interestingly, Bill Burns on UFO Hunters had a situation where they laid out a series of thin materials, and anybody who wants to watch this, they can go and find these with a Google search and watch the video clips on it. And they had two people who came in who we are very sure actually handled the material, and they said, "Do you see the material here that you handled?" They both said yes. They both picked up the same piece. It was thin material. When you crumpled it and you let go of it, it straightened itself out. You couldn't burn it. All of the attributes that Jesse Senior said were there. There is a great lecture that's you can actually again find with a Google search on the Mogul Project and how all of that worked. There's a physics lecture from UC Berkeley, and it takes about an hour long. It tells the how, what, when, why, where, and this is exactly the kind of material. Yes, there would have been a lot of it. No, nobody at White Sands or at Roswell would have been in on the project at all. We were talking one of the major strategic, what they were looking for was they knew that the Soviet Union was close to popping a nuke, and they wanted to know when it went off. And even having the only atomic bomb wing in the world did not require those people to be involved in the sensor collection system. And were they heavy-handed when they went in and did clean up? Yep, think absolutely. One of the things I point out, as you mentioned, was at Los Alamos, and they were describing a lot of the experiments, and we found out they had done some things that were, by today's ethics, kind of questionable, radiation experiments and things of that nature. When you listen to the people give the explanation, and again, these are all available. The first thing is always, it was a different time. Meaning people today cannot remember. I mean, I think you and I are old enough to remember duck and cover and
Sure.
things of that nature, where we were worried about attack from the Soviet Union. We were talking about national survival, and the kinds of things you do in that regime is very different from what we would do now. By the way, one of the things that gets me into a lot of trouble in lecture, most of the time, I do things that are in national, international security, but I give talks to the military, and I just say, America is not at war. America's at the mall. We got the military is at war. We're spending 4% of the GDP. World War II, we were at war with 40% of the GDP. And we were just coming out of that. We were worried about national survival, and you do things differently under that kind of scenario.
Let's talk for a second about now. You don't believe that there is a controlling organization like an MJ-12 now.
Nope.
I'd like to know if you believe that there was at any point some sort of a cover-up. And I ask it in this context: there was a memo from an Air Force a general named Bolander who, at the end of Blue Book, when Blue Book is canceled, and the memo basically says, "Look, Blue Book is canceled, but all." UFO cases involving national security should continue to go to the same place they've been going, implying that it's not Project Blue Book. You put that piece into the consideration as well as, okay, go ahead.
No, I think you're right. I don't put a lot of credence in that. It did. Would remember the same place is Wright-Patterson.
Right.
That is where Blue Book was. So to say it should be going there, to say any case regarding national security ought to go in, that makes perfect sense.
Well, I think the memo doesn't say where it's supposed to go. It just says it's supposed to go where it was going before,
Yeah, but
just not to.
we know where that was. I mean, that was going to Wright-Patterson.
National security cases, UFO cases,
Yeah, well,
sidestepped Blue Book
any
and went.
yeah. Now, there, as you know, The UFO crowd likes to point out to the regulation about reporting unidentified objects in the Air Force.
JNAP 146, that thing?
Correct.
Yeah.
And, you know, what that really says is anything that is a threat to the United States. It doesn't just say report any weird thing that you see. Again, generally misconstrued. So, for them to say skip things that are a threat would have been irresponsible. But this thing, we're shutting down the program, meaning we're not going to chase lights in the sky and, you know, Mary saw something flying over the house or whatever. I mean, we do remember, and those, even those that are proponents of UFOs say 95% have prosaic answers, misidentifications and things of that nature. The point, as you and I know, is that you end up with this residuum of cases that no matter how you try to explain it, just don't go away. You know, hard evidence, highly credible witnesses, multi-sensory data, things of those nature.
Here's what's bothered me in studying this for a long time. It's the attitudes, probably years ago, the attitudes of the 50s and early 60s, the Condon Report and how that was manipulated, the Robertson panel, which said, UFOs don't appear to be a threat to national security, but reporting them could be a threat to national security. And this, we need to have a program of ridicule and debunking.
Right.
The attitudes of, when you file a FOIA request, how hard it is to get information or, being misled. It seems like there was a long history of misinformation, disinformation, some of it very active. When you look at Rick Doty and some of the stories that were told to UFO investigators, it seems like there was some kind of an active program. Your position would be maybe, but just not.
No, I see it more as there are two issues that you've raised that are totally legitimate. And the one that concerns me greatly is the one that you mentioned, the Robertson panel and the Condon report, where they say, we've got to debunk this, that this is basically, going to destroy American society because they're believing in weirdness. And we can't, as you know, in there, it goes so far as to say, schools should not be allowed to teach this. We should not give credit for students who write reports on these sorts of things, even in creative writing. And it shows a very pedantic response to it. Now, one of my slides we go into, and I think one of the big issues is when you start looking at belief systems, and what you find is that 70% of the public believe in various kinds of phenomenology, and UFOs are right up there in the 70% level. When you look at professors in general, you're down to about the 50% level. When you look at other scientists, you get down into 15%. When you get to the National Academy of Sciences, and this is the level that these studies are being done at, you're down at 4%. So part of the huge disconnect is that the belief system of the general public and the belief system of these very conservative scientists are so different that, it's a chasm of gulf. You just, they can't even talk to each other.
It's bad for science.
Hence the concern, we can't even allow this to be discussed. I talked in there about Sagan. Have we got time? We're about to go to break, I think.
We're about to go to break, but that's a good topic to come back on because, you mentioned the belief system. Science is sort of a belief system. It's become, as you mentioned, its own religion in regard to this stuff. I want to jump right back into that when we come back after the break. My conversation with Dr. John Alexander continues here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Dr. John Alexander, author of the new book, UFOs, Myths, Conspiracies, and Realities. He's told us he doesn't believe there is an active UFO cover-up, but he believes that UFOs are real, that they're coming from somewhere else, that they're interacting with us in various levels. So what does he think they are? We'll get into that discussion, a little bit about NIDS and the Skinwalker Ranch and other topics as well, right after this on Coast to Coast. John Alexander, before the break, we were touching on the idea of science as its own religion. The disconnect between big-time, top-level scientists and what the general public believes. And you've seen, and you even referenced them in your book, the statements from science that belief in this paranormal stuff, it's bad for science, it's bad for the country. You can't let people consider it. You could look at it a different way, as if it's this kind of topic that could interest people in science. If, in fact, you believe science is a way to resolve this mystery.
Well, I certainly think science has a great place to play here, but that you hit on the issue of science has become a religion, and we will. It's interesting this notion of breakthroughs and whatnot. We're willing to push the envelope a little bit, but real breakthroughs are very, very hard to come by, and they always start with disbelief and being rejected. I mean, I'm sure the famous quotes of, the atomic bomb will never go off. I speak as a explosives expert. So there are lots of, almost every field you get into where conventional wisdom just said it can't be, therefore it isn't. But one of the things that I am pushing for that I think is worth discussing, though, is I think we've got to make it okay for scientists to be involved in studying these things without jeopardizing their career. And the problem now is, and I think the quotes that you gave earlier, then, ad hominem against me and Scientific American, are perfect examples of that, where, just even touching the subject can become toxic. And that's true in science. It's true certainly in politics. And again, we see this great gulf between that and the general public.
You have some, we have some mutual friends, Dr. Hal Puthoff, a physicist, just an absolutely brilliant man who may win the Nobel Prize one of these days. Some other folks, also PhD level guys who were involved with you in the National Institute for Discovery Science, established by Bob Bigelow here in Las Vegas. Some of the people associated with this were willing to allow their names to be used. A lot of them weren't, precisely for the reasons you're talking about, because it could carry a professional cost just to be willing to ask questions about these topics.
Well, there's a guy that I've sort of, listed in the dedication, and I now have him up on my website, which, by the way, is www.johnb.johnbalexander.com. Dean Judd, whom I protected for a long time, he was one of those who did not want his name exposed, died suddenly last fall. But the point was that, here was a guy who was the chief scientist of SDI. He was the National Intelligence Officer for Science and Technology. He was a senior fellow at Los Alamos National Laboratory, and he was interested. Now, he was a true skeptic, and he and I would have great debates on this. But even with those kinds of credentials, he would say, I'd just as soon be behind the scenes. And you get that quite a bit because your peer group will crucify you if you become known as interested in any of the phenomena.
And there are consequences. For example, you can't get a paper published about UFOs, can you, in a straightforward science
Oh,
journal?
there's several. If you go to any of the main journals or and any fields of phenomenology, I mean, Nature has been, kind of the classics. You mentioned Hal. He was able to get some stuff on zero-point energy and fizz rev, but very theoretical. If you went in with the UFO topic, there's no way that you're going to get that past peer review. There's Ted Rockwell. He's one of those guys whose name, Ted was the technical director for Rickover for the development of the nuclear navy. And as you put it, the peer reviews are the Inquisition of the 20th and 21st century. The 50-50 rule, I spent half of my life getting my doctorate. I'm going to spend the other half keeping you from not.
Talk to me about NIDS for a second, because, and I ask it in this context, is that, some of the same kind of ad hominem attacks at you have been directed at NIDS. You were pursuing officially and unofficially, while you're in the military, these UFO mysteries and finding out who knew what. You did the same thing in a private capacity when you hooked up with Bob Bigelow and his organization,
Right.
and some of the because you are affiliated with this, and because Bob is a guy who doesn't like a lot of attention, the same kind of dark rumors swirl around. Well, those guys in NIDS, those guys in Las Vegas, must be, trying to get the alien technology for themselves. It's dark, it's shadowy, it's evil.
Yeah. Well, of course, you've got to give Bob a lot of credit. When NIDS was developed, it was set up to look at two specific areas, UFOs being one. The other one was continuation of consciousness beyond physical death. Lots of personal reasons. He was willing to risk substantial amounts of his personal funds in causing that to happen, allowed us to look for quite a few years at it. Now, of course, he then went on, he's got now Bigelow Aerospace, and they have the Bigelow Aerospace Advanced,
Bass, right?
BAS, that does somewhere. But if you've watched, again, on the blogs lately, it's, oh, this is terrible. This is really a cover up. They're trying to steal the technology and all that. Well, there's nothing to steal, but
Well, it's like ufology has always done. It's like Phil Corso told both of us a long time ago that the government doesn't have to destroy ufology. The ufologists do it for them,
I have said that forever. If I were a skeptic and I wanted to destroy the ufology, I'd do nothing. I just sit back there and watch them eat each other alive. The cannibalism in the field is just, epidemic.
Well, right now, I mean, MUFON is under attack in part because of its association with Bob Bigelow and Bass, that somehow this is a takeover of the organization by the secret government. And, I guess in some ways it's amazing MUFON has survived as long as it has, given the nature of ufology and ufologists.
Yeah, but in reality, there's not much to take over. I mean, it's not like they have capital resources or have some interesting networks, but belief systems are pretty split. I am going to be speaking at the MUFON conference as well, and that's going to be on, after disclosure. As if, and of course, one of my pitches that I'll be disclosure has happened and happened and happened. And they say, well, why doesn't the White House do this? Well, they have. Starting with Truman, Carter saw them, Reagan saw them. The White House has already stepped forward and said this is real. Well, nobody chooses to believe that.
Talk to me about the ranch for a second, the Utah ranch, the Skinwalker Ranch that we wrote about and which Bob Bigelow still owns, because that has also come under attack recently. The stories range from nothing ever happened there, according to the previous owners, so there's nothing, we're making it up, or that there was a battle between security forces and aliens on the property,
Oh,
or that you guys found rods of pure Element 115 there.
I saw that.
So,
Yeah,
I don't even know where to
the
begin to
rods
talk about.
were, they did find rods. They were from arc lanterns, very well known, had nothing to do with Element 115. I've heard these preposterous claims made. Again, this was part of the attack on MUFON. That said, I think both of us would agree. I think I was the first person to overnight up there, from NIDS. And some very, very unusual things happened. And again, your book describes them in great detail. I've got a few of them in my book. And it's interesting because we talk about the relationship between those kinds of phenomena and UFOs. Sometimes there were UFOs involved, other times not. And this is why I get to the end of my book where I just say, universe is far more complex than we ever anticipated. And as you know, I've advocated for a long time what I call a step back approach. And I think what we need to do is to go in on the wall and post all of the observations of these phenomena without saying this is a UFO, this is poltergeist, this is remote viewing, et cetera. And then see how do these pieces fit together. Then you do the macro pattern analysis and see what emerges. And the things that emerge from the ranch are some, as you know, just totally bizarre cases, but with highly credible witnesses and physical evidence that just defy any conventional logic.
Well, that's what people have trouble with. Well, this isn't like any UFO case I've heard. Well, it's not a UFO case. Or right. They'll say, this is not very convincing. Well, nobody's trying to convince anyone of anything. In fact, Bigelow and NIDS didn't want any of this information out for a long time or forever, basically. I had to try to talk them into it. But you can see why you look at the experiences of the ranch, A, why no one would want to talk about it since nothing is repeatable, and B, the kind of challenge that presents to science, and how do you categorize something like that?
Yeah, with great difficulty. And in fact, in the book, you know, something that we had discussed years ago when I came up with the concept of the precognitive sentient phenomena, which is probably too complex to even venture here, except to say you can read about it. But it just says that this is terribly complicated, and there's something that is sentient, i.e. smart, and it seems to be in charge. It presents, you know, various kinds of situations in ways that are just very hard to define. And as you know, the ranch was instrumented, meaning we had cameras that were going 24/7, time-lapse photography, those things being reviewed. Things happened out there that we know they happened and yet don't show up on the camera, and they should have been there. And series of those.
Well, it helped me with big picture stuff then. Do you not allow yourself to reach a conclusion or even get close to a theory on what the ultimate story is? I mean, the old version of UFOs as being visitors from another planet seems so simplistic now, and which doesn't seem to fit the larger pattern of information.
Well,
do you have a theory?
Yeah, do I have an answer? No, I, as I put it in the book, we're not even asking the right questions yet. And everybody wants the conclusion. What does it work? Well, for instance, interaction between humans and non-humans has been recorded as long as there's been recorded history. More recently, those are called UFO abductions or meeting aliens or things of that nature. That's actually a relatively new wrinkle in it. What you're looking at are phenomena that have existed for a long time. As we mentioned earlier, what is a UFO? Is it the balls of light that are sometimes described, or are they these huge craft that we pretty sure exist, that in physical reality, and when I say huge, we're talking maybe a mile more across, and everything in between. So to just say these are little green guys from Zeta Reticuli who are stopping by just does not seem to fit the observations they're coming from, like I say, one specific point, two here. I think we're asking the wrong questions, and that's why we need to go back to the basic fundamentals. I argue that UFOs offer a great area for real basic science.
It's as if we don't really know what they even look like. I mean, so many different forms have been reported that maybe it's a matter of manipulation of consciousness, and we have no idea what they really look like or where they're from or what their craft are.
Well, I do think that explanation is closer than anything. I do argue that consciousness is a component of what is, you know, causing the events and the observations that are taking place. And, you know, what you hit on is just right. It could be that it's a physical object. Now, we do know a number of them, as I say, are recorded with multisensory data. So that means it's not human eyeballs or in the brain, per se. But in the Cash Landrum case, those helicopters, we know weren't there. And yet they were reported by a number of people, certainly seen. Now, one hypothesis is holographic projections. Another one is a way to directly have humans, you know, see it in their brain, even though it's not there.
Is it a solvable problem? You mentioned that it's a great exercise for science as a way, you know, as a stepping stone, at least, towards solving it. Is it solvable, or is it just meant to be a learning curve and lead us down a path?
Well,
give us the answer, John.
As you know, one of the things I have, what I call Alexander's law of appropriate complexity. And that says that in life, wherever you are, you're presented with a number of challenges. And just as you get to where you figure out how you're going to handle all of those challenges, a whole new order of complexity emerges. And I think that's what's happened here, is it started with a fairly simple problem. And then as you begin to look at it, and if you take into account all of the observations that are coming from credible sources, and one of the things we haven't hit on and might spend some time on this is the non-credible sources, and that, you know, it just defies explanation, certainly defies any simple explanation, but is certainly worth exploration.
I'm sorry to hit you with this in just the 3 or 4 minutes we have before the break, but I do want to get your take on what's going on in the Middle East. You touched on it briefly, but you work for a lot of these military think tanks. You write papers for people in military positions.
Yep.
It just strikes me that this could end up really bad in all kinds of ways. I mean, you know, you got to root for people to overthrow tyranny, but that this could be bad in a lot of ways.
I won't say it's bad. I will say it is critical. These are strategic moves that are taking place. The issue that everybody addresses is one thing to get rid of any of these people, but what follows them? We have a long history of, you know, supporting strong leaders in there that are then seen like, you know, tyrants later on. We threw Mubarak under the bus pretty quickly. I have known for a long time that the Egyptian people were quite upset with him. They were very upset when they thought that his son, who was being geared as the groomed as the heir apparent, as soon as he left with his family for London, which happened before the riots got really serious, I said, it's over. You know, that was the signal that it was collapsing.
Same in Iran?
Iran, Libya tonight, they say Benghazi is now under control of, and they've had actually a revolt of certain army units in Libya. Interestingly, how it started. I missed Tunisia, and I think most people did, because we thought that was, yeah, he had a strong leader, but relatively stable. But the instability and the potential for what follows, unfortunately, while the Muslim Brotherhood was not a strong group in Egypt before, they were probably the best organized. And I think you are going to see a very strong call for very fundamentalist Muslim and maybe theocracies emerging.
Well, if one happens in Saudi Arabia, then we should all be pretty worried.
Well, I think it was before 9/11, I had said that I had predicted that Musharraf, Mubarak, and the House of Saud all fall. And I got two down so far. And, you know, some others. I was a bit sorry. I knew that Abdullah in Jordan, certainly a moderate and a supporter of the West, but they had huge Palestinian problems of their own. And now that is really in jeopardy. That would be a critical blow for support for American policy in the Middle East.
Dr. John Alexander is my guest. John, sorry to interrupt you there. That music from Marshall Tucker means we're going to the break. When we come back, we'll be opening up the phone lines. I'm sure a lot of folks have questions for my guest tonight. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM.